The Broward Sheriff is feeling the pressure now from his own department. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The union representing the Broward Sheriff's deputies is holding a poll of no confidence. The union's president says there are issues with the sheriff's management after the Parkland shooting. We'll have the latest update. Joshua Johnson is the host of the national NPR show 1A, but a lot of listeners in South Florida remember Joshua years before as an on-air reporter at WLRN. It's a one-on-one between Joshua and me. And one of the leading crime podcasts on iTunes follows a grisly murder in South Florida that was caught all on videotape.
I've seen a lot of murder and death after the fact, but to actually see it unfold, it's breathtaking and it's stunning.
The people behind the Sun Sentinel's Felonious Florida joins us. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, the union representing Broward County Sheriff's deputies is holding a no-confidence poll of its leader, Sheriff Scott Israel. The head of the union, Jeff Bell, argues the poll in part is due to concerns of how Israel handled the aftermath of the Parkland shooting. Israel says the poll is merely a political stunt. Voting began on Friday and continues until Thursday evening. The Miami Herald's Chuck Rabin has been following the development, and he joins us now from the Doral studios at the Miami Herald. Chuck, thanks so much for joining us today, man.
Sure, good to be here.
All right, so this is the first time, my understanding, in history of the Broward Sheriff's Office, a no-confidence poll has been taken. I mean, how did this get started?
That's what I was told by the union president. Apparently what happened was Jeff Bell, who is the president of the Broward Sheriff's Office Deputy Association, had sort of been holding back a little in the aftermath of Parkland, and he started ramping up and came to the conclusion that due to, you know, the sheriff's actions after the shooting and some other concerns, he was going to hold a vote of confidence, which is purely ceremonial. I mean, the sheriff is elected, so it really has no bearing on his job.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, could the poll have any sort of impact on Sheriff Israel's job at all?
Well, it's a punch in the gut, you know, as far as seeing how, you know, your troops react to you, if in fact they don't show confidence toward them. But it doesn't, you know, and it may sway a future vote, you know, who knows how it'll affect them.
Tell us a little bit about Jeff Bell. Again, you said he's the president of the union representing the deputies, but he's been an outspoken critic of Israel.
That stems mostly to contentious labor negotiations that's been going on for a while now. Apparently, they're seeking about a 6.5% raise, and they've been offered 3%. The sheriff said that, you know, this is all political. He said that he spoke to Bell probably a week or a little more ago, and Bell told him that, you know, with Parkland going on, now was probably a good time to try to get these negotiations squared away.
Since the Parkland shooting, the sheriff has been in the spotlight, attacked for how his department handled it, criticized nationally for on this. But, you know, what would a poll like this do, you know, will the poll, let me put it this way, be a reflection of that discontent over how Parkland was handled?
It could be in part, but it, you know, a lot of it would be the labor negotiations as well. As far as, you know there were issues with Parkland. You know that the sheriff relieved a deputy, Scott Peterson, almost immediately. Well, he eventually resigned because he didn't enter the building quickly. There were also dozens of calls into the BSO and feds that warned of Cruz's actions, one saying he wanted to shoot up a school. And, you know, the sheriff claims that they answered correctly on most of them. Some they should have probably gone and taken action when they didn't. He had that interview on CNN with Jake Tapper that didn't go off so great when he, you know, called himself amazing. So there have been issues.
You know, talking about Deputy Scott Peterson, could Sheriff Israel have overstepped his bounds in his criticism of Peterson the days following the shooting?
I don't, who's to say? He took immediate action. I mean, he waited, he reviewed, and then he determined that Peterson should have entered the school immediately. It turns out there were three other BSO deputies who got there who did not enter the school either. immediately. I believe it was Coral Springs who went in first, and that was another issue. Coral Springs didn't feel they were getting enough credit, and it all kind of built up.
All right, the sheriff's office, as you've already said, democratically elected position. When is Israel's term up?
I'm not certain of that. I believe he's been there for about 6 or 7 years, though.
Okay. You know, the Broward Sheriff's Office is uniquely powerful. This, according to The New Yorker, it has the largest fully accredited sheriff's office in the country with some 6,000 employees, an annual budget more than $800 million. What does that mean for Israel's level of influence?
He's still the top cop there. You know, he's still going to run it. They run the jail system up in Broward, which is one of the largest in a city run jail in the country. It's a huge budget with a lot of deputies, and as long as he's elected to that post, he's going to be in charge of it.
You know, this all comes during this ongoing discussion about school security, not just in Broward County but throughout the state. Has Sheriff Israel said anything about the role the Sheriff's Department should be playing in protecting schools?
He hasn't jumped forward on anything. They've accepted, offers from the governor on using, I think it's FDLE or FHP troopers to help at the school. They've ramped up. But he hasn't really gone crazy with how he's going to protect the kids.
You know, this is one of those cases. I mean, we see this, it's all over the nation, and something like this obviously puts, a particular officer or sheriff in the spotlight on the national level. And so now this has happened. And actually, it's the second thing that's happened, because there was the Fort Lauderdale shooting, which also, again, put him in the spotlight. Just from what you've seen, if anything, all of this attention over possible missteps, because again, there's still an investigation going on. How has that helped or hurt the sheriff in the way people see him?
It probably hasn't helped him. He's voted into office, which is common in the state of Florida, except in Miami-Dade, and you can see how politics plays into that. So who's to say if that's the best way to go about it, electing your sheriff? But yeah, they've also had two terrible things happen in Broward County in the past year. I mean, the Fort Lauderdale shooting, I think 5 people were dead, and the aftermath, there was reports of another shooter, and they hadn't set up their command center properly. People were stuck at the airport for 10 hours. And then the Parkland shooting. I mean, most people go their entire lives without having huge incidents like that they have to deal with.
Have we heard anything from the Coral Springs Police Department, that's the neighboring law enforcement agency, about, do they have any concerns over the sheriff?
They have a new chief in Coral Springs now. I don't know what their actual stance is right now. I think they've kind of mended fences.
So the poll officially ends Thursday evening. What could we expect following that release?
Well, it's, this union represents about half of the deputies in Broward. There's another, I believe the PBA and the FOP also have some representatives. So it'll show, whether he has the support of his troops or not. It's a large voting bloc. It comes with family members and cousins and friends, so that's typically why you see first responders and police and firefighters, why politicians go after them so strongly to try to get their help. So it could be a punch in the gut.
Again, we've been talking with the Miami Herald's Chuck Rabin, talking about Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel, again in the spotlight. They're holding a no confidence poll this week, this coming from the union that's representing the Broward County Sheriff's deputies. Chuck, it's always a pleasure, man. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Lewis. I appreciate it, man.
All right, we're going to keep up on that story, and we'll see if we can get the sheriff in here to see what he has to say about it. Well, still to come, Joshua Johnson, familiar voice in South Florida for listeners, not just because he's the host of 1A. No, it's because, this is where he got his start, and he's back at WLRN. Coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, he's the host of the NPR national show 1A. His career started here, though, in South Florida, and it goes back before he worked at WLRN. I mean, he's had this dream of hosting since he was a kid. That's my understanding. That's what I learned He's back at WLRN with me on Sundial. Joshua Johnson, hello.
Hi, Lewis.
Great to have you here. Now, listen, I wanted to start things off, and I'm not going to be insulted if you say no, but you're back in Miami. Mm-hmm. You've got to have a cortadito with me.
I don't drink coffee.
No! Stop. I'm going to put this over here anyway.
And yet he gives me a beverage I don't drink.
I'm gonna.
I will have it. Oh wait, hold on. I will have just a sip.
Just a little bit. All right. So
here we.
There you go.
All right. There you go.
Cheers.
Typically, I don't. I'm usually a tea drinker because it's better for my voice and it's better for
my
stomach.
Right. But you're absolutely right on that. I agree with you.
But that's all right. South Florida makes you do all kinds of things you never thought you'd do.
Well, I'm just saying you're from South Florida. Come on, it's just a normal thing.
There you go.
What's it like for you coming back home?
It's good. It's good. It's nice being back and seeing that, you know, WLRN is doing well. The newly built out newsroom, which looks nothing like it did when I was here. The studio is different. This studio that we're in is different. I remember when I worked here, I started in this building and we were kind of all kind of in this space before we had our space at One Herald Plaza, which was, you know, the old home of the Miami Herald before they moved to what was the headquarters of U.S. Southern Command. So it's good coming back, seeing what's here, what's different, what's changed. All the new construction is kind of incredible. All around WLRN,
all the towers that keep popping up.
I mean, there wasn't a Publix 2.5 blocks from here before. So just the economic implications of what's happened, seeing the new art museum, the science museum. Like, I remember when some of the fights about downtown Miami and what was going to happen with that patch of public land were hot. So to come back after I left in 2010 and see it now is just, it's interesting to see how investments in public space, even just Miami-Dade County's investment in the arts and how dramatically that worked really well. It's fascinating to be able to look back.
And you were born and raised in West Palm Beach.
Yes.
How often do you get back home?
Not terribly often, unfortunately. My family's going to come down for tomorrow's event with MCCJ, but I try to get back as much as I can, but DC keeps us really, really busy, as you might guess.
No, I can imagine.
Yeah.
But, no, I mean, as I wonder, like, you know, for you, do you consider that home? Because you were raised there, and I wasn't born there, but I was raised in West Palm. I have family that still live there. Even though just like you, this job takes you all over the place, and I go back once in a while. I do, because my parents are still there. I have to. I should. But I still consider it home. I don't know. How do you feel about, is it home?
It's, West Palm is my hometown. I moved to Washington, D.C. from San Francisco, where I worked for about 6 years for KQED Public Radio. California feels like home now. So I miss San Francisco every day. D.C. is beginning to feel like home, but it's not quite grown on me yet. I'm grateful to be from South Florida. I don't miss it except when it snows. Then I really, really miss South Florida. But I mostly am grateful that I got to start my public radio career here when I went running, screaming from local television news and decided that I needed something that was more my speed and that was more in line with my journalistic philosophy. Public radio kind of called my name. I never expected this to be my path. So I go forward grateful, particularly because South Florida was basically my boot camp / officer training school for being a journalist. There's nothing I've encountered in my journalistic career since I left here that has really freaked me out, because I got to do so much as a reporter here that, you know, I left here feeling like, okay, I'm ready.
So I read that you, I mean, this really goes back a ways for you. You always kind of had that dream, that idea that you would be some kind of announcer or host or something like that.
I always knew I wanted to create and host my own show. I didn't know what form it would take. I didn't know that it would be on NPR. I never guessed it would be on NPR. I just knew I liked public radio. I thought it could be on television. I didn't know if it was going to be commercial, non-commercial. I didn't know NPR had room for someone like me. For someone who was as loud as I am, who was as kind of energetic and aggressive as I am, for someone who is black, for someone who doesn't have that kind of NPR sound where we'll talk very thoughtfully about the sociological and geopolitical implications of today's
biggest
story.
Now, wait a second. What's wrong with the NPR voice?
Well, everything when you're talking about something important. I mean, I and I'm not knocking other people's style. If that's your style, that's fine. But I one of the things that I love about 1A is that we allow people to speak in their own voices. I feel like a lot of people who don't listen to public radio don't listen because they don't feel like they're calm enough or smart enough. there's an issue that they're really fired up about and they want to talk about it, but they can't calm down before they talk because it's important to them. They're scared or they're angry or they're upset or they're ticked off for reasons that are legitimate. But because of the impression that we give, they think that they have to be more erudite and worldly or even esoteric to be welcome here. And I feel like if we don't combat that image, then we affect the story by forcing people to calm down, by not creating space for people to speak in whatever accent they have, with whatever slang they have, whatever mood they're in. Like, that's part of what public radio does well. And it took me a long time before I realized, oh, I'm welcome here. I don't have to sound like someone else. I have to learn to sound like the best version of me. And then I'll be able to be on this medium and do some real good. And that is exactly what happened to me. Like, as I continued to grow, I got better at this work, and now I get to do work that, you know, pretty much lets me be myself.
Now you've got me worried if I've got the NPR voice. I'm going to be
You're just fine. The only thing to worry about is if you are hearing someone else in your head and trying to sub-vocalize as them, as opposed to just speaking yourself.
Did you ever feel any pressure to conform?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you know, when you start, like when I started at WLRN, we were kind of creating WLRN, what was then WLRN Miami Herald News. So it was all new. And I hadn't been a professional radio host before. I mean, I got the job partly on the strength of my journalistic chops and also because I was local. I remember saying to the news director at the time, look, I know you've got candidates from CBS and NPR and the BBC and wherever, but I am a turnkey reporter. I already know how to pronounce Ileana Ross Leighton. I know the difference between Miami and Miami Beach and Miami Gardens and Miami Shores. I already know how to get from City Hall to County Hall and back. I know the highways. I know the people. I know the entire region. So you can hire someone else and train them with all their little worldly wise ways, or you can get a South Floridian who is reporting on his home, who's reporting to his neighbors who already know him. Make your choice. And they chose me.
I bet you wouldn't know now. It's all changed.
You know?
It's all changed.
I was like, was I really from here? Did I ever live here?
Everything is so different. And especially back up in West Palm.
Very different.
As you've seen. I mean, like, you know, and look, I remember growing up, all those roads, Belvedere, Southern, 41, all those were little tiny roads, and now they're just, you know, 4-8 lane highways.
Yeah, the story of development in a lot of ways is kind of the story of South Florida, not surprisingly, and I will be interested to see how in the next few decades development and environment intersect, because the environment is not going to allow for all the development that we would like to do. So something's going to have to give somewhere, and that's going to be an interesting beat for someone to have.
I'll tell you one thing I have seen is that we've started to build up.
Yes.
Since we can't seem to build out anymore. By the way, just happened to you, where did you go to high school?
I went to Suncoast Community High School in Riviera Beach.
Suncoast.
Yes, the home of the Chargers.
Oh, they whooped up on us really good all the time.
That's what we do.
Wellington High School.
Yeah.
Class of 91, by the way. I just have to throw that out there so they know I'm listening. You know what, though? I wanted to come back to something you just said a second ago. I'm curious. Do you think people still have this image of NPR, like the joke that they used to make on SNL? You know, the delicious dish that everybody just talks like this.
Well, or on Parks and Recreation with the Dan Castellaneta character.
Yes.
Welcome to Thoughts for Your Thoughts. I'm Derry Mirbel. There's a reason that's funny. And I think that in a way, it's just very silly and it's very funny. That is changing. I mean, I think NPR and public radio in general have done a better job of elevating voices that aren't the typical, you know, Elsa Chang and Noel King and Glenn Washington and Sam Sanders and all these new and diverse voices across public radio. The challenge is making sure that people know that those people are welcome there. I think it was Sarah McCammon from NPR who tweeted out some nasty note from some listener who's like, you sound so squeaky on the radio. None of the male commentators sound this way. Please fix this.
I saw that.
And I just wanted to punch my phone like, she is a woman. Women can sound authoritative without sounding like a man. Stop being stupid. But even beyond that, there's a larger issue of the growth of public radio. 35 million people a week listen to NPR's programming, and about 99 million listen to NPR on air and online. That's great, but that means that about more than two-thirds of the American people have no relationship with NPR at all, and about 90% have no relationship with a member station. So there's a lot of room for us to grow. And if we don't concertedly proactively inform the world that we are determined to sound like the communities we serve, we're not going to grow. There's no law that says people have to spend their time with WLRN. WLRN succeeds because it sounds like South Florida. That's why Sundial is so important. But if people don't know, they're going to have that delicious dish stereotype in their head. We have to make sure people know Thoughts for Your Thoughts was just a joke. It's not the reality, at least not anymore. And that's our job.
If you haven't guessed, I'm talking with Joshua Johnson. I mean, for heaven's sakes. Host of 1A. He's here in Miami today. He was doing his show from here today, and he's back in South Florida because he is a South Florida guy. He may say California feels like home. He's a South Florida boy. I don't care what he says. That's the way it is. You know what? I'd read that about you. What I thought was interesting was that you're going into your second year. By the way, you've just said, but January, you guys celebrated 1 year of 1A.
That's right.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
That you didn't want to go into cruise control, that you want to keep growing the show. So let's go to what you just said a second ago, because I find that interesting. You have your typical public radio listener. They've been listening for a long time. Every now and then somebody kind of jumps in on it. But how do you and how have you gotten some of those folks who would always just like, you know, just raise their chin at us, would just snicker at us, would just ignore us? How do you get them to want to listen?
Well, I think part of the good fortune of 1A is that we are the successor to the Diane Rehm Show, and Diane left air on her own terms. So the announcement that I was hired as her successor was made on her show. She was the one to make the announcement first before the story went out in the Washington Post and everywhere else. So she was the one to kind of pass the baton in a way to make it okay for her fans to like 1A. I don't disdain legacy NPR listeners. People who like that sound, people who love the more erudite kind of esoteric content that we have the bandwidth to provide, they're great. There's nothing wrong with that. The trick is making sure they know that they're still welcome here, even as things are changing. And one of the things we took great pains to do is to make clear that Diane and I have a lot in common. I grew up in part listening to Diane Rehm on WLRN. So a lot of what I learned about doing my work, I learned from her. So we are both very broad-minded in our interests of different topics. We are both very strong believers in the mission of public radio. We are both deathly allergic to double talk. And we both like creating a forum for civic conversation, which I think after the 2016 election is more needed than ever. And it would have been necessary regardless of who won. I mean, we either were going to have the Donald Trump administration, or we were going to be a nation that was learning to deal with its first female head of state. So either way, the national conversation was going to change. And she made it clear to the audience, certain things are not changing. They're building on the legacy of the Diane Rehm Show, but not building over the legacy. It's still there. It's just going to sound different.
By the way, it was a really fascinating moment last week when she's a guest on your show.
Yeah.
And you guys, I mean, by the way, just tackling this really heavy topic that you were dealing with, death and the choices we have or don't have. And, you know, she's been very outspoken on this topic, but what was that like for you? I mean, you know, you guys have been on the air before as when she handed the baton over to you, but now she's a guest on your show.
Oh, that was fine. She's an easy guest. She was a very easy guest. Because remember, she wasn't pushed out. She wasn't fired. She left. She left entirely on her own terms. She has been, cross my heart, nothing but supportive. She's been gracious. She hasn't hovered. She hasn't cajoled. She's never given me any advice. She ended her program, raised a glass to us, literally raised a glass to us, and went on with her life. She could not have been easier to deal with. So when she came in as a guest, I wasn't really worried. Like, she knows the drill, and she was easy.
I wanted to know how all of that came about. She had made the announcement that she was going to be leaving, and then she told everybody over and over, this is my plan. As they're looking for the replacement, as they're looking for the next person.
Right, the successor. One replaces Diane.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
I mean, what was that process like, and how did you get involved?
I had done a program when I was at KQED Public Radio in San Francisco called Truth Be Told, which was about race in America. It was a program, a limited four-part series that was distributed by PRI. PRI also distributed a program called The Takeaway. And the executive producer of The Takeaway was hired by WAMU to build the successor program. So he had heard me before on The Takeaway and had heard my work. And he as they were looking for hosts, they threw my name in the list to give me a shot. As I understand it, I was the very last person to audition at the very end of September. So they flew me in. I shadowed Diane for a day. And then I hosted the Diane Rehm show for 2 days. And that kind of got me in the list. And I made it for interviews and phone screens and ended up being the person who got the job.
And then once you got it, did they have already the idea for 1A? Or is it once they brought you in, then you really helped build out what that was going to become?
They had the idea for what they wanted to keep and what they wanted to change from the Diane Rehm show. The basic mission of the show is basically the same, civic dialogue, a variety of topics, the Friday news roundup, etc. But the format was going to change. For example, we don't take calls every day. We have a different kind of array of views and topics. We had a chance to build a new team of people. So there are two holdovers from the staff of the Diane Rehm show, but the rest of us are all new. And so that much was there. But the other pieces of it, the name of the show, the theme, the host, were the creative parts that had to be built. The goal, the station also considered whether they wanted to continue doing the show. That's an option too. Do we want to do a show? And then if so, what will the show be? So the important stuff, the heart of the program, the mission of it, that was all settled by the time that I got in the process. And then it was just a matter of figuring out whether I reflected those values back to them and whether I had the skill set to do the work.
So you get this opportunity, and look, here's the thing. You take this program after we go through this contentious election, and as you said, no matter who had won, the world was going to be very different after that. But Donald Trump won, and since then we've seen this polarization. People will say that it's worse than ever. Everybody's got their take. And of course, we've seen this rising up of an alt-right and, of course, white nationalism on levels we haven't seen in a while. You've taken over the show at a time when things have been really tense. What has that been like for you in hosting this show?
Just another day at the office, man.
You did a show about race, but now does it seem like it's more intense than usual?
You know, it's you take it one day at a time. And I think if I look at it in the totality of what it means in society, I will have a stroke. I won't be able to function. What I can do is today's show. Like, all I can do anything about are the 2 hours I'm hosting today. We can plan and plot and kind of beat the ideas up as best we can in the editorial process. And then I have to let it go, let the producers build, and then focus on what I can work on today. I think in terms of what I do from day to day, I've had to kind of think about the way I deal with interviewees in the interview process. It's hard to be impartial when you're talking about things like race or sexual harassment of women in a workplace. And what has served me well, and this is just me, is thinking of myself journalistically less as impartial and more as clinical. And what I mean is, I used to work in medical research. I was on a pre-med track before I came to my senses and went into something steady like journalism.
You could have been the Dr. Joshua Johnson.
I would have been bored to death. But I remember working in labs and, you know, you go in the lab, you have to scrub your hands real well because whatever germs were with you, you know, you have to let those go and then you can do your work. And as soon as you walk out, they jump right back on you. And I think about my journalism that way. This studio is our lab and people have agreed to come in as guests and really be dissected live on the air. My responsibility is to make sure that this sample stays clean, that none of my biases or prejudices or stereotypes or misgivings contaminate this sample that we are publicly dissecting. So before I walk in, my goal is to wash my hands of that. Now, I can't get it all off. There's no way to be purely clean in a lab. And those germs will jump right back on me when I leave. So I don't have to disavow my beliefs. But I have to decide to wash my hands of them when I come in here. I can't be impartial about racism. I can, however, have a clinical conversation with someone who believes that statues of Confederate generals have a place in our society and ask him thoughtful questions. Well, when was the first time you saw one? When you look at one, what goes through your head and your heart? When the statue was taken down, what did you lose? I can do that without pretending that racism is okay.
So how do you deal with listeners or anybody who criticizes you and says, nope, I'm hearing bias, I'm hearing, you know, all your opinions? And of course, you know, over the last couple of years, we keep hearing the fake media. We're just fake anyway. How do you deal with that?
Well, with the term fake news, anyone who listens to 1A knows that I hate that term fake news, because if it
I don't know anybody who likes it. I hate it too.
Well, some people do. They like to use it as a cudgel. The problem is that if it is fake, by definition, it's not news. So stop saying that. What is it actually? Is it propaganda? Is it misinformation? Is it a lie? Is it faulty reporting? Call it what it is so we can fix it. If you call something fake news, you're just throwing a stink bomb in the classroom. Okay, go to the principal's office. But if you have a real problem, if I did say something that smacks of bias, if I did get something wrong, please, for God's sake, tell me. I would like to improve. And if we actually made a mistake and you heard it and you care about this institution, you owe it to us to speak up. It's incumbent upon you, because this isn't just a one-way process. We're not just dumping information in your brain anymore. You immediately become part of the process when you open your mouth to complain. You're part of the dialogue, so own it. What's wrong with the broadcast? Well, you said such and such and it's biased. Okay, let's go back and take a look at it. Thank you so much for bringing this up. And even if we don't believe that they're right, even if we think they're just a crank and they're just being upset, at least they own their part of the process. If you just sit at home and complain and never pick up the phone or never write an email, that's okay too. But if all you want to do is insult us for making a good faith effort in a public institution that your neighbors have built over decades with their hard-earned dollars, if all you want to do is just poo-poo that process, then you are insulting something that your neighbors built for you, and you are doing them a disservice, not me.
Can you court those listeners? Do you want to?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. We've had, when we do visits to stations, there's always someone at the event who says, I wish more people listen to NPR. How can we get them to pay attention to your program? And one of the first things I admonish them is, be very careful about who you call them. No one likes to be othered. No one likes to feel like they don't count. And that's part of the challenge with our dialogue today, is that people don't feel like they belong in the dialogue. What we look at as someone's bubble might really be their scar. They might have been burned by our institution in the past, by some story we did, or maybe they did try to complain, and they learned, I really don't belong there. So I can't judge them for how they feel. I don't know why they feel the way they do. And if we claim to be a space where everyone is welcome, that also has to include our critics if they treat us with respect. We have to model what we want from them. So instead of othering and say, why don't they listen? Let's make sure we're the kind of place they want to listen to. Are we not covering the topics that they're interested in? Are we talking about the same things all the time? Are we doing a good enough job of reaching out? Are we responsive to criticism? And for that matter, are we asking them to just tell us their story? What would you like us to talk about? There's always a way to bring somebody in. It's not my job to drag them. If they don't want to show up, that's fine. I'm just going to lead the horse to the water. Can't make you drink. But our job is to be a pool from which the whole nation is thirsty to drink. That's our job, to make sure that it's deep enough for everyone and it's pure enough that we keep it clean, so no matter who shows up, they will be nourished by what they find here, and then let people make their own choice.
I've read you're a big fan of Oprah.
She's all right. She'll do.
Well, I've read that, there's an admiration there for what she's accomplished in her life.
Well, yeah. I mean, the fact that she's able to create a space where, like, the whole world shows up to hear her talk about just about anything is kind of, it's kind of what we do in a way. Like, public radio is this very omnibus space to talk about all kinds of things and not just the scandal of the day. And we have a lot of people, millions of Americans, who will go out of their way to find us and prefer us over everything else. So it's incredible. I mean, I grew up, in kind of her heyday. So yeah, who didn't?
But it's to say, do you want to be the Oprah of public radio?
I would like for public radio to pick up where Oprah left off. I think Oprah gave up something when she left television that she's clawing to get back and can't have because she's a CEO now. And I think that the idea that there is no place for the nation to come together and talk is belied by institutions like WLRN, by shows like Sundial, by shows like 1A, that are a space where everyone is welcome. And we need that, especially now that it is so comfortable for people to not only remain in their silos, but build their own through social media. We still need to come talk. We are still the nation of we the people. The founders intended us to have one big national conversation to figure out who we are. Not the only conversation, but we have to have that. And public radio is already positioned to do that. So, yeah, I would like for 1A to be the number one program on radio, commercial or public, and I would like every station that airs 1A to be the number one station in their market, commercial or public. I think that the nation needs to know that if you want to know what's going on, the first, best, and perhaps only place you should go is your NPR member station. And then go see what everyone else has to say, because this is where you're going to find the best version of that conversation.
Save that tape. We've got a pledge drive coming up. Save that tape for later on. Let me, Joshua, when we finish up on this, have a little bit fun, because you would understand this. As anybody who lives in South Florida, you can answer these questions.
Uh-oh.
All right. Just it's quick rapid-fire questions here, but uh-huh. you'll got this. All right. Favorite beach growing up in Palm Beach County?
Singer Island was closest. I didn't go to the beach that often, but Singer Island I always loved.
Singer Island? All right, that's a good one. I went to Lake Worth a lot.
Although Virginia Key Beach State Park, when it reopened, it's like the only unobstructed view of the Atlantic Ocean. It's magical. It's just incredible. And it was the historically black beach. It's phenomenal.
Very good. Very good. All right. I know you said you didn't drink coffee, but I was going to ask this. Cafecito or cortadita?
Whatever you're paying for,
whatever
basically.
You're paying for. There you go. Okay. Love bugs. Palmetto bugs.
Am I supposed to like one or the other?
No, just...
That's a trick question. We were doing very well.
Yeah, okay.
We were having a very pleasant conversation.
All right, there you go. Best Publix sub to order.
Best Publix sub to order. Whenever I go to Publix, I usually order the chicken fingers or the fried chicken. I don't order the subs there. That's a trick. That's a trick question, Lewis.
That's all right. You know what? They have a chicken finger sub.
Although one of my coworkers at WAMU was lamenting just the other day how much she missed Publix subs. Because they are a thing. Safeway does not rate.
You should know this. Zoo Miami or Lion Country Safari?
Oh, now you're asking me to get deep and philosophical on you now. I love what Zoo Miami has done. Man, they've got people who love that zoo. Lion Country Safari was kind of a standby in my youth because it was close, but I always loved what used to be called Miami Metro Zoo. That's
okay.
They're both worth the drive, but right. Metro Zoo's that Zoo Miami's worth the drive.
The Biltmore or the Breakers?
Oh, my grandmother was a housekeeper on Palm Beach for decades.
Oh.
So anything related to like that guilt society of Palm Beach has got a little film for me. So Biltmore. Let's just say Biltmore.
All right. And Fantasy Fest or Sunfest?
Oh, my goodness. Sunfest. I performed at Sunfest when I was 16. And it was the first time I ever performed before an audience that fell silent. And they were outside. It was like 2,000 people.
I got 30 seconds. Explain that.
I performed The Lorax by Dr. Seuss. It was something I had done in speech and debate and won competitions with. And someone was like, you should do that at Sunfest. So I performed it on one of the stages, the stage of like 2,500 people. And I get to the part where they chop down the last truffula tree. And the whole audience was silent at Sunfest. And it was the moment I was like, whatever I do for the rest of my life, it's got to have an audience. I have to do something where I feel this from people. And here I am.
And if anybody was at that Sunfest,
96,
and remembers the 96 Sunfest, please find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial, and tell us about that one. Again, he is the host of 1A, Joshua Johnson, here at the WLRN Studios. Joshua, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lewis.
Enjoy the rest of your time here back home in South Florida before you head back up to D.C. All right, still to come, it is one of the hottest podcasts right now on iTunes, Felonious Florida from the Sun Sentinel. What is it with true crime podcasts? Why are we fascinated by this stuff? We're going to talk to the creators of that podcast. Coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, more than 24 years ago, two assailants broke into a wealthy club owner's home in Miramar and murdered Sharon Anderson, Marie Rogers, and Kazimir Sukarski. The entire murder was caught on tape. But 24 years later, there's another trial coming this summer, as this case has not yet been resolved. That's the story behind one of the hottest podcasts out today from the South Florida Sun Sentinel and the podcast company Wonderly. It is Felonious Florida. Its producers are Lisa Arthur, David Schutz, and Juan Ortega. Its host is Lisa Arthur. And Lisa and Juan are joining me now from the WXEL studios in Palm Beach County. Lisa, Juan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, Luis. Good afternoon.
How did Felonious Florida come to be? Take me to that meeting. Take me to that moment. Maybe you guys were having a drink, a coffee or something.
Juan and I were working together in our Palm Beach County newsroom, and we used to sit next to each other. And every once in a while, we'd start talking about podcasts. And we were both fans of podcasts. And I had been a longtime cops reporter. I like true crime stuff. And so one day I kind of just looked at him and said, you know, if we like these so much, we should just do one. And we pitched it, and our insane bosses said, sure, you two guys who've never done a podcast before, we'll let you go ahead and do one. Thankfully, they did that, and that's how it happened.
And I mean, Lisa, how much did you know about podcasts before you did it?
Well, when they finally, when they said yes, we were kind of surprised, and I went out and bought Podcasting for Dummies, so that's how much I knew. I mean, I knew I listened to them. That was it.
And Juan, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, when she approached me with the idea and we were kicking around all our love for podcasts, I thought it was a great idea. And from there, I was equally surprised that we got the go-ahead, and I was excited to go forward with it and be able to tell these stories in a longer format that really engaged listeners.
And Lisa, you were with the Sun Sentinel as a reporter, right? Covering this, one of the cases for this story back in what, the early 2000s?
I was at the Miami Herald then. I was at the Herald from like 93 through 2008. And during that time, I filled in whenever that trials went on for like, Seth's trial went on for 8 months. And I filled in for the courts reporter, and I actually was there the day they sentenced him to death. And so it's such a dramatic story, the Casey's Nickelodeon killings, because of that videotape. I mean, even today with all of our video, it's very rare that you see a triple execution happen right in front of your eyes. And so I would always check back, and I came back down here in 2016, tired of the New Jersey winters. And I looked, and it was like, wow, one of these guys has been released because he got acquitted, and the other guy's conviction had just been overturned. And when we started to kick around the podcast idea, this season's actually two stories, the Casey story and then one that Juan worked on. Casey's was just a natural because it was so dramatic and so unique.
And Juan, let's go back over this story just a little bit. I mean, anybody who hasn't listened to the podcast, there may be a few little giveaways here, but we're going to try not to ruin it for anybody. But I mean, this was a story, a murder that took place, I believe it was in 1994 in Miramar, in this home. And as Lisa had mentioned, it's like seldom do you have a crime like this that was videotaped because the owner of the home had cameras in his house. So we see the entire gruesome thing. But just briefly, what was this case? What was this story?
Well, I'll let Lisa get into the guts of it. But like one of the things that stood out to me, you made a good point, which is that this surveillance and this videotape is from 1994. And everyone like now is totally accustomed to having the ability to be able to pull out their cell phone, shoot video. And even though there was surveillance video back in the day, I think it took a lot of people by surprise to see that this heinous triple killing was recorded in its entirety on videotape.
Lisa, these murders happened, I mean, this is 24, almost 25 years ago, and yet there's another trial coming up this summer. Why? Why hasn't this been settled?
The one guy who got convicted and sentenced to death, Seth Penalver, his trial came back. The Supreme Court found that there was actually very little evidence, and it was retried, and he was acquitted. Pablo Ibar, you know, when you get sentenced to death in Florida, you get an automatic appeal. Seth won his. Pablo didn't win his. He then appealed again and said he had insufficient counsel. His lawyer at the time was sick, and he was also having personal problems. There's a famous story about how they were all in court waiting. The first trial they had in 1997 ended up in a hung jury. And then in 1998, they're in court getting ready to be tried together again. And Pablo's attorney, who died a couple years ago, his name was K.O. Morgan, you know, he basically comes in his pajama top and pants, and he's covered with blood because he's been arrested on a domestic violence charge. And that's how the case ended up getting split into two. And Pablo's next trial lasted only 6 weeks, and the Supreme Court found that K.O. didn't do a good job, and K.O. agreed that he didn't do a good job. And so that case came back in 2016, much to the lament of the families of the dead folks. I mean, it's just wrenching for them that this will now be the fifth trial they have to sit through.
Again, I'm talking with Lisa Arthur and Juan Ortega. They are the creators. Lisa's the host of the new podcast, Felonious Florida, produced by the Florida Sun Sentinel and the podcast company Wonderly. Right now, one of the hottest podcasts on iTunes. And again, it's following the story of this crime, this murder that took place in Miramar back in 1994. And as we just heard from Lisa, well, there's still another trial. Yeah, 24 years later, this hasn't been closed yet. You know what? Where did the name Felonious Florida come from?
We were brainstorming. We have a guy named Danny Sanchez at the Sun Sentinel. He's like a product engineer, and he's very clever, and he came up with a list of words, and we were standing around one day, and the three of us liked Felonious, and then we just kind of said, well, it's got to be Felonious Florida because, you know, that's the selling point. Florida really is the star of the podcast because everybody in the country just expects all kinds of hijinks from Florida. And so there's just that built-in audience. I mean, that's where the name came from. We start a new story tomorrow, actually, that Juan's going to be the host of on the Boca Town Center murders.
All right. Now, I want you to hold that because I want to get to that as well. But you know what, Juan, real quickly, though, I mean, look, true crime podcasts do well. But this thing took off really quickly. Did you expect anything like this? What was it like when you saw Felonious Florida hit up there in the top three? I think it was hit number one at one point.
Yeah, we obviously you put in a lot of time and effort and you always hope for the best. But obviously no one could have predicted that it would take off as well as it did. And within the day of its release, I believe it debuted on April 3rd, it shot up to number one on the Apple Podcasts and remained there for, I want to say, more than a week. And since then, in just 3 short weeks, it has reached more than 1 million downloads. So there's a lot of that's great, you know, to know that. And it also is helpful because, as I mentioned before, you know, it gives a chance to tell these stories in a longer format where it gives you an opportunity to get into details that might otherwise be overlooked. And for I'll hold off on talking about the subsequent case for now, but it also, you know, brings these cases back into the spotlight in a big way. And I think that's a huge benefit.
A fascinating aspect of this podcast is, again, that it's a crime that took place so long ago. The technology was very different. But you find some of these folks to talk to all these years later. One of them was one of the suspect's wives, Tanya Ibar. And here she is discussing the experience of going through this ongoing investigation.
We're sitting here now, 20-something years later. Really? I mean, have I not shown now? I mean, this is not a life that anybody wants to live. There's so many nights that I've gone to bed, you know, beside myself, crying and just wondering, when is my life going to be? I mean, I have so many friends, their lives are going on ahead of me, they're having families, they're having weddings, they're going on vacations and doing things that, you know, are the norm that you would actually have. And that wasn't me. I was getting up early at the crack of dawn to go visit Pablo, drive a long way to wait outside, to be humiliated.
Again, that's just one of the cuts from the podcast. Lisa, you know, I mean, you're done with this story, except that, again, there's going to be this trial. How are you going to follow up? What's the plan?
Well, you know, we're working on season two right now already. And as part of that, we're going to release some bonus episodes as the trial goes on. We'll have audio from the trial and we'll definitely cover the verdict. And we'll try to do some interviews and have some bonus episodes.
All right. Now you have you're going to have a new story to tell, though. Juan, you were starting to tease us up. I just wanted to kind of build that up a little bit. But what is the next story? And I remember this case, by the way.
And that's your very same reaction has been the reaction along the way in me talking to the investigators on these cases, the victims' families, and a lot of longtime South Floridians here. It's a string of kidnappings and murders that all happened in 2007. Perhaps the one that put everything into such a big spotlight was the killings of a woman named Nancy Bocchicchio and her 7-year-old daughter, Joey. And they were found shot dead in the back of their SUV on December 12, 2007. And from then on, the investigators ended up also noticing that it was very likely that those kidnappings and killings were related to another family who had been kidnapped from the very same mall just months earlier in August. And that mom and 2-year-old boy lived to tell about it.
And that's that podcast is coming out this week, correct?
That's correct. And there's also connections to, like, Miami. This killer who may still be out there has, the investigators have said, you know, he definitely potentially has some links to Miami, because that's where some of the belongings were left from one of the victims, a cell phone.
So. Again, I've been talking with Lisa Arthur and Juan Ortega. I have to end it there because of time. They are the creators of the new, one of the hottest podcasts on iTunes, the new true crime podcast, Felonious Florida, from the Sun Sentinel and the podcast company Wonderly. Lisa, Juan, thank you so much. Appreciate your time. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.